Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. The Wednesday Morning Show will begin in just a moment. We have two interviews coming up on today's Morning Show here on WGTD. In part one, we're going to be previewing the latest theatrical production that is opening this weekend at Carthage College, a very intriguing play called The Invisible Hand. In part two of today's program, you'll hear a conversation about how the worlds of arts and business can come together in some really intriguing ways. Just a quick word about some other morning shows that are coming up in the near future. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, we're going to be welcoming into our studios a special guest to the campus of Carthage College, a Carthage alum who is now an accomplished forensic attorney with experience with the FBI. His name is Joshua Lamb, and he is an executive in residence for Carthage and will be joining us in the studios tomorrow. On Friday, you'll hear my conversation with best-selling novelist Jane Allison, the author of a novel that is in some ways also a memoir. It draws heavily upon her own life. It's a novel called Nine Island. And I have to say, of all the conversations I've had with various novelists over the years, this is actually one of the most interesting conversations I can remember having in quite some time. So I hope you can make a special point of listening to our conversation on Friday's program. Next week, we have a number of interesting programs, including on Monday the 10th, two different author interviews concerned with Pearl Harbor. One of them with Curtis Smith, whose new book is already regarded as perhaps the definitive account of the events leading up to Pearl Harbor and what occurred in its aftermath. The other conversation will be with the author of an interesting book called Fields of Battle, which focuses actually on the Rose Bowl that was played in January of 1942, right after Pearl Harbor. And it tells the story of the various men who competed on that football field, that Rose Bowl that was transplanted from California to Durham, North Carolina, because of concerns related to the war that had just begun. And it traces the line of those young men from the gridiron to the battlefield and what they experienced. Quite an extraordinary book. We'll air both of those author interviews on Monday. We remind you that the Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. We're delighted to have with us in the studio for part one of today's Morning Show, first of all, Herschel Kruger, who is professor of theater at Carthage College, and with him, Marie Treadway, who is a senior theater major at Carthage, and his co-director for a play that is opening this weekend and running next weekend as well, a play called The Invisible Hand, written by a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, Ayad Akhtar. And it is a play which touches on a number of, let's say, contemporary or timely themes and blends some themes together in some ways that are quite unconventional. So I'm glad that we have a few minutes talk with our two guests about what sounds like quite an intriguing play, again, opening this weekend at Carthage College. Professor Herschel Kruger and Marie Treadway, we welcome both of you to the morning show. Good to have both of you here. Something's not on. Let's hope that let's say good morning again.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning.
There we go. Good morning. One more time.
Good morning, Greg.
Yes, thank you. So good to have both of you here. Professor Kruger, let's talk for a moment about the selection of this play to be part of Carthage's season. When was it chosen and what drew you to it?
Well, I was drawn to the play because I've become a fan of Iyadaktar, having read and seen his other plays, Disgraced, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and his other play, The Who and the What. And I was, looking for a project for a student to direct, because there were several students who wanted to apply for one of two studio slots where they could direct a full-length production in our studio theater, which is fully supported by the department. And it seemed that the project for The Invisible Hand would work really well, because there was a role for it, a role in the play for me. And I had done this before with Biloxi Blues, where Tommy Novak had directed. So Martin McClendon and I talked about the students who we thought were applying for a studio position, and we had a couple people compete for this, and we gave them the play to read, and we interviewed both, and had them speak about their ideas, and we chose Marie, and it's an exciting project to work on, both with Marie as a co-director and also acting on stage with three of my students. So it's always a challenge. You're learning together, you're growing with the play, and with each day building on what you've done the day before. And Marie's been doing a great job, a very sensitive and capable storyteller, and a good leader, and a good collaborator. All those things are so important as you take on a production like this, or any production.
Great. Well, we'll be anxious to hear all about what this experience has been like for you, Marie. Professor Kruger, first of all, tell us a little bit about what I just touched on briefly in the introduction, the really interesting kind of uncommon blending of themes that is part of this play, and who you are playing in it.
Yes. Well, the play is centered around the kidnapping of an American banker who's in Pakistan and actually working on some deals to possibly privatize water. And we actually mean to kidnap his boss, and we get this guy. His name is Nick Bright, played by Carthage Theater Junior Justice Good. Anyway, Nick isn't the guy we wanted, but we're still holding him for $10 million ransom.
So you're thinking he's a big wig, and he isn't quite a big wig.
Yeah, but he's still pretty good. In terms of the $10 million, he has a couple million dollars in an offshore account that he's going to utilize to play the market in order to earn his ransom. Hmm. And that's what's set up. So my character is Imam Salim. He's the one who organizes this small network. The Imam is a terrorist. He gets put on a terrorist, watchdog list. So the government's and the bank, Nick, the banker, works for Citibank. So no one will negotiate with him. So that's why Nick is forced. And he comes up with this. Nick is fast, and he maneuvers quite well. And he comes up with the idea to take his money and to raise his own ransom. So the main characters are Nick and my lieutenant, so to say. His name is Bashir. And so Bashir is the one who works with Nick. And, of course, they start off really on polar opposites. And it's not a play about this kidnapping and about terrorists. It's a play about East meets West. And it's about how they learn from each other and forge a relationship. And Nick is able to drive a wedge between Bashir and the Imam, And as he does, without giving anything away, things begin to unravel, and the play goes in a very different direction. There was a lot to learn also about this play. We've been fortunate to have three wonderful professors at Carthage who helped us. Dr. Jim Lochtefeld, who's a religion professor, and his focus is on India and in that region. So he was our history professor, history dramaturge, all about India and Pakistan and its history. Dr. Fatih Harpsi, who is a religion professor, and his work with understanding Islam and the practices and the history again of this religion and very misunderstood religion, as well as Dr. Yuri Maltsov, who was our economics dramaturge. Mm-hmm. And then we had a student who coordinated all of that, and his name is Spencer Bingham, and they were all just instrumental in helping us understand this play. It's easier to sit and listen and understand, but in order for people to listen and understand, we have to know exactly what we're talking about. So that's why their work with us was so vital.
So is it just a cast of essentially four?
Yes.
Wow. Which is one reason why it works so beautifully in the studio theater.
Oh, this is the main stage.
Oh, it's on the main stage. Oh, I misunderstood you. I thought it was in the studio theater.
No, there are two student productions in the studio, but that's why we had several directors, and we wanted to be able to give another one an opportunity, and it is on the main stage.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, we should talk for a moment at some point about the challenge of making this play work in that kind of space. But let's talk to Marie Treadway. First of all, tell us a little bit about this kind of opportunity and how much directing you've done before this.
Right. So I transferred in from a community college, and I had assisted my previous director as an AD for a Stephen Ali Gyurgis play. And then I've also directed some Broadway revues and some cabaret kind of things. But this is my first directing thing at Carthage. I took a directing class with Professor Kruger last year, and in order to propose a slot for the studio show, you have to take his directing class. So because of the selection process, now I'm directing this main stage show, which is a very rare opportunity, and I'm just extremely grateful and humbled by it, and also very excited about what it means. You know, we're kicking off the season, and it's a main stage show, and I've been working with a great cast and crew, so I'm really excited to show what we've been working on.
That's great. So tell us how this has worked in terms of you being, I think, officially a co-director.
Yes.
But I suspect in many respects, Professor Kruger is probably allowing you to really take the reins. What has this working relationship been?
Right. So we've been working together mainly on the pre-rehearsal stuff. So things that I'm not too familiar with, like technical elements and production meetings, Professor Kruger's really helped guide me and helped lead me and kind of explain things as we go along of what to look for when we look at scenic design or things to note when we're talking about costumes and sound and just how a director collaborates with these designers to hone in on this kind of core statement that they want to make of the play. And so he's really helped kind of nuance that. But once rehearsal started, he kind of took a step back and kind of went into actor mode and took off his director hat. And so throughout rehearsals and throughout the actor process, the rehearsal process, I've kind of taken that lead and have more of that direction of just the main director in terms of acting choices and guiding the play and shaping the play and its mood. So
I should think it's a challenge in a couple different ways. First of all, I don't suppose it's the easiest thing in the world to direct your own peers. And also, I imagine it also feels a bit strange to direct your own professor. Can you talk about both of those sort of potential points of awkwardness that might be part of this? And maybe it hasn't been awkward at all.
You know, just in generally, the play touches on the skeletal framework of it: high investment finance, Pakistan, terrorist groups, things that I had never knew about or even researched or thought about before this. And so I was really worried about how I, as a director, am I going to bring some sort of honesty and authenticity to this production. But delving in with my cast, they're extremely hardworking, and they're very diligent and focused on bringing this honesty and truth. And I think working together on it, with so much focus, I don't feel like there was any problems in terms of them taking my direction or taking notes. And it is a little strange to have Professor Cougar, me telling him what to do, and stand here and, yeah, you're kind of off your dialect today. And so it is a little, sometimes I'm like, what am I doing? But the process itself, I haven't felt any sort of discord or tension or weirdness. And I think that's a testament to them and how open-minded they are to kind of show that respect. And it's been really great.
And I suppose that's an important culture to foster in your department amongst your students, because chances are they're going to experience this one way or another when they're out in the world acting. You never know who your director is going to be, and you need to be ready to be receptive to whoever that might be and whatever they might say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't have chosen Marie if we didn't think she was up to the task. And I think when she gave my first note and I just said, okay, thank you, or whatever, I think she was fine from there on out. And but, you know, working with the students, they could see this isn't a perfected art form, that I go through the same struggles with them in understanding my intent and my action and trying to create my character and working in this complex dialect. And, there's a lot of ups and downs, and, but that's part of the process. So they see me going through the same process and having some of the same struggles that they have. So it's a great learning environment, and I'm learning as much as they are. And it also reminds me about still being on stage, how much work it is and what the dedication and how much focus is needed to, pull it off.
Marie describes you as having taken your director's cap off and entirely become an actor. Is that literally true, or have there been at least brief moments where you've needed to actually doff that cap just to maybe just mildly correct something that might not be quite right? Or
sure. Within the first couple of weeks, I helped with some blocking, and I helped with some initial scene discussion. We did a lot of table work. We spent a couple of days just reading the play, talking about each scene, why does it take place, what's important here, etc. And after we got through blocking, I started stepping back more and more. We discuss the play in rehearsals almost every day, whether it's 2 minutes or 20 minutes. And even last night, or it was after 11, we had long night of dress rehearsal, and we walked out and we stood in the parking lot and talked for 5 to 10 minutes after we had spoke inside, because we both started thinking about all these other things that we want to have take place in the next 20 hours before we have our next dress rehearsal, which is tonight. So, I think an important time to step in was for her first cue to cue, and I kind of let her through the first hour of it, and then I just kind of stepped back and she ran the rest of it. But just to kind of, just give her a little push, and she's a pretty quick study, so she was right on top of things, and she also has a vision. But part of it is communicating with your team and feeling confident to try to make something look right or sound right, or move the correct way. And it was just kind of giving her that little nudge to say, you're on track. Make the choices that you want to make and get them to look or to sound or to feel the way you want them to before you move on. And that's what you do. I mean, we spent 4 hours just working on cues, the ins and outs of any light or sound cue and any other special effects. So we didn't do the rest of the play, but we just did those cues. So that's a really important step. Because without that, your next rehearsal is where you want to start running the show with the tech elements, if they aren't right, you can't really move forward. Right. You can't just wing it.
Sure, not with something like that. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Herschel Kruger and with Senior Marie Treadway, who they are co-directors, and Professor Kruger is one of the actors in a play called The Invisible Hand that is opening this weekend at Carthage College by Pulitzer Prize winner Ayat Akhtar. So, Marie, what has been most challenging for you as a director in putting this production together? Some people at a glance might consider it, you know, maybe a relatively simple assignment, given the fact that it's a small cast. I should assume it doesn't have all kinds of different locations. I should think it's a fairly claustrophobic, in a sense, physically limited kind of production. But that doesn't mean it's simple. It just offers a different array of challenges. What has been most challenging for you?
I think simplicity is so hard to achieve in sometimes in a production, and all of the business can distract from truthful storytelling. And so I think that's been my challenge. At first, when I was approached about this production, and like I said, this kind of overview plot of a high investment finance banker being kidnapped by a terrorist group, I'm like, what? How can I tell this story? I'm so worried about these topics that I do not know, and I'm really worried about telling the story. But at the root of it, this story is about person's survival instinct and their idea of self-preservation and what they do when they're put to the test, or do their ideologies clash with their actions. And that's something that anybody can relate with. But because it is such a small person cast, and Ayat Akhtar doesn't write any throwaway characters. And so even our fourth actor, Ben Brown, he plays Dar, who is just beginning his role in this terrorist group. He has a huge arc. And so to really polish that and nuance each individual character and why you're doing the things that you're doing, what's the next level, how do we up the stakes, how do we keep this urgent, what's new every time you step into the scene, what is this life-altering, like, change that you're about to undertake? And so even with just four people, it's really difficult to drive that and push that every day to make that urgency and that and that overarching drive in the play to make it happen every day without them plateauing. So
right. I mentioned this to Professor Kruger before we went on the air, that when I first read a very brief description of the play, it looked like a thriller, maybe somewhat akin to a play that was done at Carthage several years ago that involved a hostage situation.
Two rooms.
Kenton Rowerding was in that. That was really
good memory.
And I thought, I figured this would be some roughly akin to that in some respect, at least. And then I read the full synopsis of it with all this, with this American banker kind of wheeling and dealing and doing through all these elaborate schemes, and his Pakistani captors sort of fascinated and bewildered by, you know, all that he was sort of cooking up. And it, as I read it, it almost read like a comedy. And I thought, oh my gosh, if I completely misunderstood what this play is about. And Professor Kruger has assured me that there are comic moments, but there's nothing funny about this play at all. But I wonder, is that at all a challenge in making it effective and authentic to not allow it to seem completely unrealistic or a little too fanciful or a little too funny?
That's interesting. I think the biggest challenge is if I'm successful at what I'm driving at, it should make the audience feel uncomfortable, almost in a way. It makes them question their beliefs and their ideologies, and are we really that different from our counterparts in different parts of the world? Do we are our beliefs really that much better than theirs? And I think it really makes you question who you are and what your beliefs are, and do they change with when you're up against the wall and your life is in question, you know? And so I think if we are telling the story right, I think the audience should be a little, not even just thoughtful, but it's something should not sit well.
Right.
And I think that's the challenge, is to really tell that story truthful and convincing enough to make the audience really think when they're laying in bed, am I really that different from what I just saw? Right? Nobody can really, at first glance, nobody really can connect with a $1 million high investment finance banker or a Pakistani terrorist, but in the long run, are we really that much different?
Right. And you wonder, what would I do? What desperate measures would I take to try to escape or preserve my life? I assume that the Pakistani captors or terrorists are portrayed, at least to some extent, sympathetically. I mean, they're not portrayed in this play as monsters, for instance.
Mm. I don't know. I think you see both sides. I think you see the ugly side, and you see the vulnerability that they have, and that's what really makes it interesting, that they are brutal, and that they are willing to do whatever it takes to justify it to further their cause. As does Nick, though. But what they do to survive, exactly what Marie was talking about before, and her understanding of the play. And the lengths they'll go to, when she says that we aren't, that the characters East or West aren't that different, because we kind of see both of them turn into each other in some ways, without giving anything away. And Ayad Akhtar is brilliant in his storytelling and creating of characters. I mean, he's intentionally provocative. Mm-hmm. He wants you to think. He wants you to re-examine what you might be closed off to, or the way you might understand why anybody makes the choices in their life that they do. And his characters say things that you may not want to speak out loud or may not want to hear out loud, or that maybe some people do. So he's provocative that way, or maybe even further, incendiary, where it's like, whoa, did somebody just say that or do that? It's intentional, if you're listening, if you're watching, I think you can grow with the play, and he's very clear in his interviews. Yeah, these people are terrorists, but if you look further than that, they're people. So how did they become radicalized? What are they working against within their own society, et cetera? He's not giving any excuses for their behavior and their actions, but there's still people who have for whatever reasons they are, have chosen this path.
Wow. So. Well, that sounds like no small feat if he has accomplished all that. So that's terrific. Marie, what does the production look like? I mean, visually, what are people going to see?
Gorgeous. So, I couldn't have asked for a better design team. The set is a centralized set, like you talked about constricting a little bit. And so all we see is this room that he's been captive in. Beautiful, warm, rich earth tones. The lighting and the sound really lend itself to make us transport ourselves to this location. And the costumes just tell a beautiful story of their character arcs and who they are when they start this play off and who they become. As an audience member, you just get drawn in really quickly by these beautiful earth warm colors and this lighting and the design of it. I'm just really excited for people to see it.
It sounds like it's going to be something really, really marvelous and quite out of the ordinary. So the play opens this weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, mm-hmm. when?
At 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. And then the following weekend, all in the evening, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all the evening performances are at 7:30. Professor Kruger, if people are interested in getting tickets, what are they supposed to do?
Well, we have a new, you could reserve tickets online. So if you go to carthage.edu/theater, and there's a link for getting tickets so you could get them ahead of time. You could also call the box office at 262-551-6661. Is that right? I think so. Or email theatertickets@carthage.edu. I think the website will take you right to reserving your tickets.
So and that's carthage.edu/theater. Last question, is Marie getting an A, or is it too soon to say? Could
well,
she still
we'll,
blow
we'll
it in this
see.
Next day or two?
We'll have to see. You know, it's a challenging job for her because, you know, she's not only doing that, and she's writing a research paper. She wrote goals for what she wants to accomplish during this, and then she'll defend this a couple weeks after we close with the theater faculty, but she's well on her way and on track. So.
Very good. Well, Marie Treadway, it was great to meet you, and congratulations on dispatching what I'm sure was a challenging but fulfilling assignment for you, and best wishes with whatever lies ahead for you.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. And Professor Herschel Kruger, it's always a pleasure to have you here as well on The Morning Show.
Thanks again, Greg.
Best wishes for the performances this weekend and the next. 8:41 the time, and part two of today's Morning Show coming up here on WGTD. It's not all that often that we find the worlds of business and strategic planning in the sphere of business intersecting with what we think of as the more creative sphere of the performing arts. But in a sense, that is what happens with our guest on this portion of the Morning Show, Bob Caparoli, who is the president of Sequent Learning Network, which is an advisory firm for the business sector. But he also happens to be an accomplished musician, an accomplished keyboardist, an accomplished composer. And in a sense, he has combined both of his perspectives together in a strategy which he shares in a new book called Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies That Inspire Action and Growth, published by McGraw-Hill Education. So in this book, Bob Caparoli is encouraging people in business to approach the matter of strategic planning, maybe with a bit more of creative flair than one might think of, where you feel maybe tied to pie charts and graphs that are all about numbers. He is suggesting that there are other exciting possibilities that really need to be a part of the creation of strategic planning. And in fact, he uses the verb composing strategic plans very deliberately. He believes that much as a musician might compose a piece of music or an artist might compose a painting, so a strategic plan should be composed with a similar emphasis on the creative process. So we have him on the phone to talk for the next minute, a few minutes, about his book, again called Creative Strategy Generation. Bob Caparoli, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So tell our listeners, or explain this sort of dual identity which you have, the fact that the work that you do, the way you pay the rent, is in working in this as president of this advising firm for the world of business, and yet someone who is also a good musician with intense interest in music and obviously a passion for it as well. How have these two things coexisted in your life up until now?
Well, up until now, they've really kind of coexisted a bit separately, or at least I thought. You know, I've always used music as a creative outlet, continued to do it as a hobby. Of course, I would have loved to do it full-time coming right out of high school and college, but, you know, went into a business career like I think many other musicians end up doing, and really enjoyed that as well. So I kind of kept the two worlds a bit separate. But as I went on in my business career, I had more success in that area. I started to realize that a lot of what I was doing on the music side, you know, composing original songs and that type of thing, I really carried over a lot of those same skills into my business career, and allowed me to be creative, allowed me to come up with new ideas and execute on those new ideas. And as I started to really see those correlations more and more, I really wanted to capture it, and that's how the book came about.
Hmm. And I suppose it must be kind of intriguing to think about melding those two worlds and melding those two approaches, and maybe melding two different worlds of lingo. I mean, you're bringing some things together that are often not brought together.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And you know, as I went through my business career, I almost thought it was taboo, you know, not that anybody would care that I was a musician or anything like that, but to think about bringing that world into the business world was something that, you know, you just don't normally see in a boardroom. But in fact, it's what most companies want, right? They want creativity from their people. They want innovative new products. And those things are accomplished by applying the same principles that you would for the creative arts. And so, you know, although I didn't formally bring it into my business world early in my career, as I began to do it more and advertise it more, it really started to resonate. Hmm.
So for you to sit down and write this book, I think must suggest at least an assumption on your part that there are a whole lot of people going about this, in a sense, the wrong way or in a deficient way when they are putting together their own strategic plans for their own businesses. Let's begin with, in a sense, the need, what you see as the need for this kind of refreshing new approach. What's wrong with creating strategic plans in the way that it has maybe typically been done, much more kind of number generated and just the facts kind of approach? What do you see as the greatest problems or deficiencies in that kind of standard approach?
So there's really two major deficiencies that I see quite commonly, and I should mention that the job that I have today, you know, I run a company called Secret Learning Network, so spend most of my days in large and medium-sized companies and corporations helping people with this very subject. So I do have quite a view into the way that many companies are doing it today. And I think the two problems that I see most often is, number one, the way that people get taught about strategy and business strategy in school is by and large by looking at the way other companies have done it or other people have done it. And that's a good learning tool because you can see kind of the pros and cons of somebody else's approach. But when you try and turn that into a framework and say, well, I'm going to do, you know, create my strategy the exact same way, or you think that you should, then you lose that creative flair and you can't ever really repeat what somebody else did. So there's a built-in deficiency to that methodology. The second piece is what you very rightly said. I think there's a lot of focus on the backup information, the data. And the data, again, is an important part of any process. But when you overly rely upon it, or you just think that a strategic presentation is all about the numbers and the charts and the homework, and you kind of remove that unique flair from it, then again, you're doing yourself a disservice. And I see a lot of businesses do that. Their strategic presentations, especially at a product line and a market level, they end up becoming a conglomeration of charts and data without a whole lot of thought to, well, what are you going to do with that? And what are you going to do differently? And that's really what I'm trying to instill in people.
We're speaking with Bob Caparoli about his book, Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies that Inspire Action and Growth. You set out a couple of sort of frameworks for us to sort of think about this, including something that's probably very important for us to touch on, namely what you see as the seven steps in ultimately creating what would be a successful strategic plan. And it's interesting how at least some of these steps harken back to the world of music. But it begins with preparation and it ends with the production, as though we were maybe putting together some sort of Broadway musical or something for presentation to a public. Take our listeners through these seven steps.
Sure. So there are seven steps, and It almost sounds cliche. I almost hoped that it wasn't going to end up at seven because it seems like everyone has a seven-step process, but it actually ends up being seven steps. The seven steps that I outline really are around, you can correlate them to strategy, but really it's around a creative process. So what are the seven steps to any creative process? And of course, what I've applied it to here in the book is strategy. So the first step is preparation, and it's really about, that's where the data and the charts and those kinds of things come in. You have to have a foundation of knowledge from which new ideas will be generated. And so that first step is about building that foundation of knowledge. The second step is inspiration, and inspiration is really all about understanding what it is that you want to do, but not just from the standpoint of inside you, but also how you want to connect to somebody else. So in business, it's really important that you don't just think about what motivates you as a company, you know, I want to make more money or this or that. It really is about what inspires you from the standpoint of wanting to help a customer, or what do you want to do for your target market? And again, the same thing would happen in music or the arts. The third step is about genre. So genre, we sometimes think of as a style, but I think about genre as a preference. So again, understanding who you want to connect with and what those needs are of the people that you want to connect with is the third step. The fourth is ideation, and ideation now will come from those first three steps. Once you have done those things, then ideas start to flow. Then you have to arrange those ideas into a way that you can connect them to other people, and that's what the fifth step is arrangement. Sixth step is orchestration, bringing other people into that arrangement, collaborating so that you could actually build the final piece, which you do in the seventh step, which is production. And that's actually producing a final work of art, executing on that work of art, and connecting with the people that you intended to connect with. So that's the seven steps in a nutshell, whether it's strategy, creative arts, music, anything else. Those same seven steps can be applied.
How would you say that these seven steps most dramatically differ from the more typical way that a strategic plan is put together? Are there some of these steps that typically are missing altogether or are neglected in more typical frameworks? Or is the order a bit different? What would you say sets this apart most dramatically from, in a sense, more pedestrian or ordinary ways of the same pursuit?
So I think the best way to answer that is that, you know, existing strategic frameworks tend to focus on maybe the foundational information, the preparation part. What is the knowledge that you have to have in order to build the strategy? And then some of them also, of course, go into the ideation part, which is, you know, the need to have great new ideas. But I think very few frameworks actually kind of step people through how do you go about taking that foundational knowledge and turning it into an idea. And again, it's a hard subject to teach, but what these seven steps will allow you to do is to take that foundational knowledge and then apply more information that will automatically lead to those ideas. I think the second part that existing frameworks tend to not cover as well is, okay, once you have these ideas, how do you arrange them in a way that connect emotionally with other people, whether that's people within your own company that you need to communicate the strategy to, or your customers, most importantly, that you have to execute the strategy with respect to. And so that's where the real creative process comes into play. It's not just about having the ideas. It's about arranging them and connecting them in a way that allows that strategy to come to life. So that's what I really tried to cover here that I think existing processes don't necessarily cover as thoroughly.
I especially appreciated in the book a moment when you talk about the importance of developing what you call the aria. That is four proficiencies that are essential for this process to be fully successful, namely analysis, recollection, intuition, and artistry. And at least a couple of those terms, I think, very seldom are referred to when people are talking about something like developing a strategic plan for a business. Talk us through these four proficiencies that you see as so essential to all this.
Yeah, so you know, a lot of people want to jump right into the process and, you know, what are the steps and then go through the steps, and it's extremely important. But I dedicate a whole chapter to saying, you know, before you just jump right into a step-by-step process, what you really want to do is make sure that you have the skills that allow you and enable you to get the most out of the process. And I call these proficiencies because skills implies that you have to have some level of skill. Proficiency says that you know have to master these skills to some extent. And the four skills of analysis, recollection, intuition, and artistry really are meant to correspond to the four questions that have been asked throughout the centuries with respect to strategies, which is, where are we now? Where have we been? Where are we going? And how are we going to get there? So analysis covers where are we now, recollection, where have we been, intuition, where are we going, and artistry, how are we going to get there, and more specifically in a unique way. And so the idea is build these skills and you'll be able to answer those questions so that when you go into the process, now you're fully equipped to actually get the most out of it.
Certainly one of the terms to which you turn again and again, and I don't think it's too much of a surprise actually, is the importance of storytelling. Although again, that's not a term that probably shows up all that often in other books or other presentations about the creation of strategic planning. But of course, when you really stop and think about it, storytelling is so much at the heart of a lot of things that we do. Just say a word about the crucial role of storytelling and maybe some words of advice for someone who might be sort of uncomfortable with the notion of making use of something as personal as storytelling in the creation of a strategic plan.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things about storytelling is it's really just a way to connect your ideas to other people. And it happens all the time. You know, if we think about watching a movie, if there's not a story for us to grab onto, we're not going to listen to any of the messages. And it's the same thing when you're presenting something to somebody else. It's becoming quite popular in business circles nowadays, but specifically with respect to the strategic planning process, once you have all these great ideas, you've arranged them in such a way that that you want to connect them. Now you have to really connect them to other people, whether that's people in your own company who need to execute that strategy or your customers. You know, they need to know what message you're trying to send them. And so I dedicate a lot of time to saying, okay, take those ideas and arrange them in a way that will allow you to tell a story and connect that story to other people so they'll feel what you're feeling and will be able to execute on the strategy the way that you want them to. So it's a really, really important element. And if you don't do it, you know, you have all the ideas in your head, but you'll never be able to get them out into the world.
Right. Well, I think you've really done a great service to a whole lot of people who find themselves maybe sort of stuck in the midst of this kind of a process. And I also appreciate being a musician myself and someone who appreciates the arts, how refreshing it is to hear terminology and principles that really spring from the performing arts brought into this particular arena. It's just something that doesn't happen very often. By and large, as you do your advising work and consultant work, do you find people to be immediately and easily accessible or open to these ideas?
You know, more so than I ever expected, to be honest with you. Again, you know, the advising and consulting work, I've started to slowly incorporate these direct references into the teachings and trainings and so forth. And that I'm doing them now more directly with the release of the book and so forth, the response has just been phenomenal. I mean, people really love connecting this business world to something that they can relate to on a personal level and that they enjoy on a personal level, whether they're musicians or not. Almost everybody loves some type of music. And so having these references just makes the process so much more fun. And I find people just open their minds up to this world that they maybe thought was a little bit more, academic and not as interesting to them. And now all of a sudden they find this passion in it. And it's just been so great to experience.
The book, again, is Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies that Inspire Action and Growth, published by McGraw-Hill Education, the author, Bob Caporali. Thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show and for talking about your interesting ideas and this very interesting book.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online.